time to wake up with Bill Finch. 203-333-9422. Only on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And we're here in the United States of America, where there still is free speech for the time being. And I want to thank Connoisseur Media for letting us exert our right to free speech and to share it with like-minded listeners throughout the Fairfield County area. We have a great show lined up for you today. As usual, we have our man in Washington, Brett Brosder. Brett, are you there?
Hey, Mayor. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here, Brett. And soon we'll be joined by Frank Recchia, we hope. Frank was going to be telling us about some sad news in the city of Bridgeport over the last few days. A man that we all know and love in Bridgeport passed away, and hopefully Frank will be here in just a few moments to help us with that. He's also on duty right now on this Easter Sunday, gathering the news. No rest for the weary. Frank is out working this Easter Sunday for News 12 Connecticut and regularly joins us here in the morning. I want to comment just a little bit here about Kilmer Garcia. Kilmer Garcia was wrongfully identified by the Trump administration, as far as we know. They admitted it was an administrative error. Then they, of course, backtracked and said he's a bloodthirsty member of the M15 drug gang. But, you know, his wife and others are advocating for him. I was looking up to see whether presidents had defied court orders before. The last time, really, that it ever happened, we had a Supreme Court justice at odds with the duly elected president, Abraham Lincoln, who stood for righteousness and fair play and freedom. Certainly Judge Taney stood for slavery and selling people in bondage and the terrible scourge of slavery. But the last president I could find that defied the Supreme Court was Andrew Jackson, who was well known as an Indian killer, a genocidal maniac, you might say, in common layman's terms today. The state of Georgia wanted to apply the rights to Cherokee land that was given to white men. And, of course, since he wanted Indian removal, he didn't want their lands or them to have any rights to property. So he defied it. I don't know exactly what happened. I wasn't paying attention back in whenever that was. you know, we're in a difficult situation where the judges keep punting the ball down the field in hopes that Donald Trump will not cause a constitutional crisis. But he seems to like that sort of thing, so he's probably going to push the envelope. Just remember MAGA folks, if anyone ever have the temerity to listen to me in the morning, I doubt they would, because I'm going to bring them facts that will make their head explode. But, you know, remember, this isn't done by people we've elected president before, Republican or Democrat, or Whig for that matter, or Democrat, Republican, or Federalist. Nobody ever defied the law. They worked through the process to change it. And, you know, when society changes, a lot of times people get frustrated and they give up on the slow and tedious process of compromise and fair play and the rule of law and peaceful transfer of power. But we've got to stick with that. And today we've got a great guest who I've known for many, many years. We go back through politics about 40 years. And this man, Miles Rappaport, has been a standard bearer for participatory democracy, the American form of democracy, where we care about compromise, we care about the process, we know it's difficult, but we know, as Winston Churchill said, the worst form of government, democracy is the worst form of government, except for everything else we've tried. And humankind has really flourished under the rule of law, the stability that that brings, the ability for people to pursue happiness. And of course, now a president bent on throwing that out into the trash bin. How we've gotten here is a mystery to most of us. But I am reading a book by a good friend, Steve Hassan, called The Cult of Trump. And I can't not imagine a better explanation for why somebody would be so messed up as to vote for Donald Trump than they were brainwashed. And let's just face it. There are a lot of brainwashed voters. Why is Fox News called entertainment and not news? Because you can't sue them for false reporting, even though they've paid almost $1 billion for lying to people over the air in their form of entertainment. That's expensive entertainment. But people continue to rely on YouTube videos and Fox News and memes as a way of making their political decision. Very, very dangerous. It's reduced trust in government. It's reduced voter turnout. And here today, we're going to be hearing from Miles Rappaport, former Secretary of State, longtime political activist, highly intellectual, the author of the book 100% Democracy, the executive director of 100% Democracy. And Brett, you must have some good questions for Miles, right?
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to talk to him, and especially with what's going on right now in the voting rights category. Briefly, regarding the El Salvador travesty that is happening, I mean, on one hand, what a disgrace that we're disallowing somebody their right to due process in the spirit of an administration that's just trying to use him as a pawn to make immigration the topic of the day and not discuss tariffs and how they've drastically increased our likelihood of a recession. I mean, it's just a disgusting display of politics at its worst.
And it's amazing, isn't it, that this was the man who campaigned on the price of eggs being too high, the price of groceries being too high. I guess that's his new word. There's some funny things going around the internet where he tries to explain what groceries include. I doubt he goes grocery shopping, but the man's completely out of touch, completely bonkers, completely screwing our country over and raising prices through the roof. The tariff wars, the trade wars are going to be a disaster. They already have been. The rule of law and the stability of marketplaces is something that liberal democracy, yes, say it, liberal democracy has given us for a long, long time. We're coming up on a break, but before we go to the break, I want to take this opportunity to introduce one of my favorite politicians, one of the strongest voices for liberty and freedom you'll ever meet. Participatory democracy is his devout religion, although happy Passover, Miles. I'd like to welcome to the studio Miles Rappaport.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, Miles, before we go to a break, just tell everyone what 100% democracy is. And I think you have your website is 100, the number, right? 100% spelled out democracy .org. But tell us just a little bit before we go to break, and then we're going to come back and pepper you with questions about how you can save the world.
All right, I'll be glad to do that. I'll give it my best try anyway. So 100% Democracy is a book that I co-authored with E.J. Dionne, who's a very well-known Washington Post columnist and a fellow at the Brookings Institution in D.C. And I learned from him that there are 26 countries around the world where voting is a required civic duty, in the same way that jury duty, serving on juries, is a required civic duty in the United States. And I was really surprised when I heard it and learned about it and said, I really got to sort of dig into this. And the more I dug into it, the more I felt like this requires some advocacy and some real discussion in the United States. So I'm eager to have that discussion with you and to continue to have it with people in Connecticut and elsewhere, to tell you the truth.
Well, listen, we want to poke the bear a little bit after you come back and put a challenge up to the billionaire oligarchy that seems to use this mistrust and lowering trust in government to their advantage to gain more power. We're going to see how people power can stop the advancement of the billionaire oligarchy right after these messages.
Join the conversation, 203-333-9422. Back to Wake Up with Bill Finch, live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And welcome back to Wake Up, where we have our man in Washington, Brett Brosder, who I was really proud to be able to work with for several years when I was mayor of Bridgeport. He initiated many great projects, including the opening of Pleasure Beach. So unfortunately, the current administration only opens it a couple times a year. We had it open for about 5 months. And when it was open, everybody should have been thanking Brett Brosder for that because he did a great job. And we're also joined by Miles Rappaport, who I've known for many, many years. He is a stalwart of progressive politics in the state of Connecticut, always fighting for the good of our democracy, for the rule of law, for the peaceful transfer of power, for voting rights to be expanded, for all the things that make America, America. And so, Miles, when you left, you were telling us about 100% Democracy, the book that you co-authored with E.J. Dionne, a very famous columnist in his own right. So he must have been very honored when you asked him to co-author the book with him so that he could raise his star even further. Your brand is a great brand here in Connecticut, so now he's a great brand here in Connecticut too. So I want to just let you go on a little bit about how 100% democracy can push for universal participation and a greater trust in government.
Great. All right, Bill. Thank you very much. And yes, I think the honor of working with EJ was the reverse of what you said. But he was a great partner to have, and we wrote the book in about 4 months and had never a single disagreement. So I encourage people to go online. It's purchasable from wherever you get your books, and published by the New Press, a great progressive publisher in New York City. You know, I want to step back a little bit, Bill, because I know you were talking a lot about, you know, the challenges that democracy and liberal democracy and genuine participatory democracy is facing right now in these early days of the Trump administration. And, you know, I think we have two, we can divide the threats to our democracy or the problems in our democracy into two. One is what's happening now. And I have to say, I'm as appalled as you are about what President Trump and Elon Musk and Stephen Miller and the whole sort of gang in Washington is doing. I mean, there's
we
no
call them politely far
are.
Right, but if you listen to Stephen Miller, there's not much difference between what he says and what the fascists said during World War II.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that they are really trying to not so much make America great again as to roll back 100 years of progress, starting with the rights of women to vote, going through the New Deal, through the Civil Rights Movement, through the Voting Rights Act, and all of the gains that that people and women and people of color have made over the last 50 years. And they're really taking aim at every part of it, including any institution that they think is controlled by sort of liberals or people who don't follow the kind of, you know, or sort of far-right MAGA ideology. I would agree with your characterization. So that's why they're going after universities. They're going after foundations. They're going after much of the federal government that is devoted towards making people's lives better. I mean, it's really an appalling situation. I do feel, although I will say I'm sort of hopeful, because I think that what's happening is that the arrogance and the overreach and the incompetence with which they're approaching all of this is building up a real resistance. You know, as the CBS News report said earlier this morning, there were, you know, demonstrations all over the country, actually all over the world yesterday, following up on the extraordinary demonstrations on April 5th.
I'd like to thank Bob Duff.
I think it's a really there's a hopeful path here to fighting back.
Just to add into that, Miles, Bob Duff and the Democrats down in Democrats and others in Norwalk had about 2,000 people on the green in East Norwalk, and it was great to see it on the internet. And here's some of the speeches. I think you're right. It's coalescing those of us who believe in America and our true principles. It's coalescing us. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I was very glad to hear again on your news report that our current Secretary of State, Stephanie Thomas, who I think is fantastic, was present at that rally as well.
Yes.
Anyway, so that's the immediate threat, and I'm full in on creating as much of a resistance and a denial and a fight back as we possibly can.
But the second threat.
At the same time, the second threat is the long-term structural problems in our democracy that make it such that the democracy is distorted and isn't as fully inclusive as it should be. And, you know, there are a lot of issues about that. You and I know about them have for a long time. There's the Electoral College, which distorts the presidential race. There's gerrymandering and redistricting that distort how congressional races go. The whole U.S. Senate is an undemocratically constructed body. And, of course, the influence of money in politics.
And also things like ballot access. You know, in Connecticut, we have pretty strict ballot access that, unlike in places where you have ranked choice voting or you have runoffs, there's many, many more people that can run and more choices. ballot access in Connecticut, having lived through that process, having lost the primary and tried to get myself onto the ballot, the only way that you can do that is to actually listen up, everybody. This is going to sound crazy. The only way you can get on after the primaries is to create a political party. You have to actually, the state of Connecticut tells you, okay, yeah, you can run. You must create a political party. Okay, now the Democratic Party in the United States is the oldest political party in the world, longest standing, and the Republican Party is not much behind it. And they've been around for hundreds, in the case of the Democratic Party, and almost a long time. And they tell you, go form your own party. And then when you do, if in my case, where one page falls out of your filing, they'll tell you you can't run. So,
ouch.
Yeah, that was Denise Merrill. Thanks, Denise. But I do think that there's a lot of structural problems. I think you obviously nailed the big ones, the Electoral College, gerrymandering, money, the Citizens United, and the U.S. Senate, where tiny little states have as much power as the others. And if you look at some of the laws that have been passed or not passed because of the Senate, it's really a handful of people in the United States. If you look at the marginal voters in the red states, what makes a state red, purple, or blue is usually only 10%. It's all wiggle room within that 10% in every state.
Right.
And because the more agricultural states tend to have that 10% wiggle room pretty conservative, the United States goes in a much more conservative direction than it should on issues like women's right to choose, gun control, and the like. If you poll those issues, they're at 80-90% on a good day. And that's not what the Senate votes. That's your point.
Right. So that's, you know, that goes to the last point I was going to make. You're spot on about it. And that is that we also have an issue with voting, with the participation level in the United States. And, you know, one of the barriers is what you've described, which is voting access and people feeling like their vote matters and it's really going to be counted. Another are that in many, many places, and Connecticut has been sort of fair on this, I would say, up until very recently. You know, the issues of how you encourage people to register, how you encourage people to vote, how much you can you use drop boxes, can you vote by mail? You know, Connecticut has been, you know, but not the first at the table on those reforms. So the bottom line is that what we have in the United States now is a situation in which for presidential elections, the 2020 election was the largest turnout ever in a presidential election, and that was 66% of the population.
All you need is a good
in
pandemic, right?
We have, what?
All you need is a good pandemic.
and
mail-in ballots. What
it's sort of extraordinary. It is sort of extraordinary. That
Rahm Emanuel famously said, never let a catastrophe go unutilized or something like that. We're going to have to take a break here at the bottom of the hour for news in just a minute or so, Miles, but we want to encourage our listeners to go to 100%.org. I think I have that right. 100 is the number 100 and then percent
democracy
percent spelled democracy. Out.
100, yeah. You're right, spelled out percentdemocracy.org. We've got a lot of information on there that I think people will find quite interesting.
And I think we'll take a break here for news on the half hour, and we'll be right back after this to talk to a stalwart protecting democracy in the United States and in Connecticut for his entire lifetime. Miles Rappaport, we'll be right back after this, the news.
Talking about what matters to you this morning. Wake up with Bill Finch. WICC 695.9, the voice of Connecticut.
And welcome back to Wake Up with my very special guest, Miles Rappaport. Miles, I know that democracy is sort of messy. There's analogies to not watching the laws be made because it's like watching sausage be made. But, you know, you elect a non-politician, a person who has supposedly this vast business expertise, which, of course, really was how many companies and how many ideas could he drive into the ground and charge those losses to other people. But let's say you think he's a great businessman, which he wasn't, but let's say you believe that. And he says, in 24 hours, I'm going to solve the problem where my buddy Putin has invaded a sovereign democracy, Ukraine. I fly the Ukrainian flag in solidarity with the people of Ukraine every day. I know they are a new democracy struggling to become even better, as you're trying to help America to become even better democratically. But now we're over 100 days, and it was supposed to be one day. So MAGA or MAWA or whatever the heck you're called, how do you justify that? He said a day. He's going to do it. He's so great. He's so huge. He's so wonderful. He did it. He's going to do it in a day. It's now 103 days, and his Secretary of State says they're going to throw in the towel. Well, there you have it. Democracy is very difficult. It takes time. And when we're up against dictatorships and authoritarian leaders around the world, it's so important to have a strong democracy at home and to support democracies abroad. We're getting away from that because we have a president not dedicated to democracy, but we can get back to that if we listen to Miles Rappaport. So, Miles, tell us how the Electoral College, gerrymandering, the United States Senate money, and participation fatigue or disinterest or whatever is going to be overturned by your organization. I just want to add one quick thing about participation. We always talk about presidential turnouts, and we had the highest, and you mentioned the highest in 2020. The highest, though, was in the 60s. Now, if you listen to the U.S. Census, they say that somewhere a little above half of Americans are registered to vote. So a 70% turnout, which we could only dream of, is really 35% of Americans, maybe 40%. So no matter how you slice it, there's too many Americans sitting on the sideline, Miles.
Right, right. Absolutely. So in your gracious introduction of me, maybe overly gracious, but I appreciate it.
You're a legend.
I have been working on these issues for over 40 years as an activist, as Secretary of the State, as the state legislator representing West Hartford. And, you know, we've made some progress, but not nearly enough. I mentioned about the presidential race. Well, if you look at the midterm elections, the highest percentage we've ever reached is 50%. And, of course, municipal elections, as you well know, Bill, are much, much lower than that.
25 to 30% if
we're
lucky.
Saying, if we, what is it? We've done all these reforms, and we've moved the needle, but really not very much. Is there anything that could genuinely move the needle? And then, really, thanks to E.J. Dionne, I learned that there are 26 countries around the world that where voting is a required civic duty, as I said.
Can you name a few?
Yeah, I can. First of all, most of Latin America uses it. Uruguay, Brazil, Mexico, actually, Peru, Argentina. Anyway, most of Latin America. But the one that we point to a lot is Australia. Australia adopted universal voting in 1924. So they have been doing this for 100 years. They get 90% turnout in every election. People love the system. The political culture is really celebratory. Election day is on a Saturday, and they have what they call democracy sausage stands where nonprofit organizations will be at the polls, and the whole thing is a celebratory day.
So I got to stop you there. So in Georgia, the Republican legislature banned handing out of water. Forget sausages. Just know how hot it gets in Georgia, hot Atlanta. They banned the distribution of water, maybe life-saving water. They banned it in order to reduce voter turnout, I assume. In Australia, they celebrate it with a 90% turnout, and they eat sausages at the polls that they get. Do we see a difference here?
Exactly, exactly. Well, listen, we have a lot of states in this country, not all, that have really tried to push back against the expansion of voting. But I'm talking about even in places like Connecticut, where we don't put those barriers up deliberately to discourage people, we haven't done nearly well enough. So I decided upon hearing all this that this is a discussion that we need to have in this country. Never been discussed before. Again, like I said, I had been working on these issues for 40 years and had never heard of the fact that in 26 democratic countries around the world, people are required to vote. So we created this. So we wrote the book. Did a lot of speaking and did a book tour as you're supposed to. This was in 2022, so it's only 3 years old. We created an organization called 100% Democracy, an initiative for universal voting. And we've tried to do three things. One is to just generally educate you know, the public and journalists and the academic community and the policy community that this really is an option that we could consider. Secondly, we're trying to get organizations that work on these issues to make the idea of universal voting part of their agenda. So you might be working on ranked choice voting, as you mentioned before, Bill, but could you also think about making sure that everyone is voting? I actually think that universal voting and ranked choice voting go quite well together, because what you have is everyone voting, and then everyone's vote is cast in the way and counted in the way that they want to. And the third thing is to try to find a couple of places around the country where we can really make progress in this direction. And I'm, there's bills in the Illinois legislature that are going. There have been bills in the state of Washington. But I'm delighted to say that we actually have a very live bill in Connecticut that is working its way through the legislature now.
Give everybody the bill number, Miles. Give everybody the bill number and tell them what it does.
Okay. The bill number is HB, House Bill 7242. And it does two things that are really interesting. One is it creates a task force, that represents different parts of the community. And the task, or the job of the task force, is to get Connecticut towards 100% voting participation. Okay, the goal here is to make sure that everybody is participating. And the task force is supposed to review what people do in other states, you know, where they have, in some states, people can pre-register at 16 and then get on the rolls. So high school students are a lot. Other states have more expansive mail-in voting than we do now. But anyway, so let's find out what other states are doing, but also let's look at what other countries are doing. So the bill actually, 7242, it passed out of the Government Administration and Elections Committee, which is a committee that I used to sit on.
Yeah,
way back
when you were a state rep.
I was in the legislature.
You were representing Hartford, correct?
Exactly. And I was on the GAE committee. They call it GAE, Government Administration and Elections, for all 10 years that I served in the legislature. Anyway, so the bill is headed towards the floor. It was passed out of the committee successfully, 13-6, just about a week ago. And we're hoping to do it. The second thing that the bill does is also really interesting, which is it allows municipalities to create pilot projects that would move towards 100% voting in the community. And so it really encourages places like, whether it's Hartford, whether it's Bridgeport, whether it's Fairfield.
Where we already have low turnouts really in the cities, yeah.
Yes, to say, what is it that we can do that really would make a difference? And, you know, my own view is that people wanted to begin to articulate that voting is a required civic duty. It doesn't have to have penalties attached. There could be incentives that are developed for it. But I think that the encouraging municipalities to lead the way is a really interesting thing. So that's the bill. We're hoping it's going to pass. If any of the listeners are connected to state legislators anywhere in the state, give them a call and say, we'd love for you to support House Bill 7242.
Now, let me ask you a question. It was my understanding that there was either an incentive or a penalty or both in Australia, which is sort of the world leader in universal voting. Is there an incentive or a penalty in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The implementation is different in different countries. So I'll just mention that in both Greece and Belgium, you are required to vote, but there is absolutely no enforcement. And nevertheless, just saying in those countries that you're required to vote, makes a big difference. The other thing that happens if voting is required is that institutions, you know, bend themselves towards making more voting possible. So my favorite example is if I were the superintendent of a school system and I knew that every 18-year-old was going to be required by law to vote, would I make civic education a more important part of the curriculum? I think I would.
It's interesting.
Answering your question directly about Australia.
Yeah.
What they do is they do all kinds of things to encourage people to vote. You can vote in any polling place in the state where you do it. So people actually choose to vote based on where the best sausages are that they find on Yelp. It's true. I swear to God, it's true. Anyway,
there's a really wonderful thing about sausage and democracy. I don't know. We'll have to just keep working on examples.
But don't worry, Bill. We are going to have vegan alternatives.
Okay.
If we get this passed in Connecticut. But anyway, so
maybe it should be pizza in Connecticut, Miles.
All right. Well, that could be an amendment. We'll think about that. Actually.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, but they make all kinds of ways in which it's easy to vote. 98%. They're having an election, by the way. They're having a national election in Australia on May 3rd. And they just announced that 98% of the people are registered to vote.
Wow.
And of those 98%, 90% will vote automatically because they do all, you know, it happens every year. And about 10% of people will not vote. And what happens if you don't vote is that they send you a letter. The Australian Electoral Commission sends you a letter and says, gee, Bill, or gee, Miles, we missed you at the polls. How come? And you can any reason you give. I was visiting my grandmother in Perth. I had to work late that day. Whatever it is accepted. If you ignore it, they send you a second letter. And if you ignore the second letter, you get a $20 Australian fine, which is about $13 US right now. So it's like a parking ticket. It's like a not too expensive parking ticket. So we think of it as light touch enforcement.
Yeah.
It's not designed to really penalize people. It's just designed to be enough encouragement that people could do it. And if you were to implement that, it would be very clear that you could also, you could do some waivers based on income. You could do a warning system. You could have people fulfill their fine with community service of an hour or two. So there are a lot of ways that you could do it. And if the task force gets passed, and we hope it will, you know, that's the kind of thing that the task force will examine.
It's funny because I have seen the $20 bills go in the opposite direction from unscrupulous politicians to voters. So maybe we ought to just hand out $20 bills. That seems to have worked for some people. That's Andrew Jackson.
I'm not really
recommending that,
Bill, but thank you for mentioning it.
That's the Andrew Jackson victory. Every time somebody is handing out $20 bills, I say, well, Andrew Jackson won that election. Yeah. Anyway, this is really fascinating. You know, in Connecticut, we have laws that nobody obeys all the time. And still, there's a tremendous public emphasis on doing it. For example, there is no enforcement for whether you recycle or not. Now, it is the law. You're supposed to recycle. Businesses are supposed to separate their recyclables from their organics and other materials, and they don't. It's all, quote unquote, single stream. Much of what we're supposed to be recycling is still being burnt in mass burn plants or landfilled in Pennsylvania and Ohio, which is more and more of what Connecticut is doing. I do like to make sure I mention in every show both the building trades, who employ me, by the way, who are out there every day, day in, day out, depending, not matter what the weather is, they're out there banging the nails, wiring the wires to build all the things we need. And I'd like to give my shout-out to them on this Easter Sunday and thank them for all they do. And the second is always to remind people that all of the issues we're talking about, and Miles is fundamental to this, but if we're going to fight climate change, we need an active and involved citizenry. It is an existential threat to our ability to live above ground as it is. Maybe if you're Elon Musk, you can go to Mars. But we're going to take a break and come back and talk to Miles Rappaport about if we did this in Connecticut, what could it look like? What could it do? And how could it make Connecticut an even better place to live than it already is? We'll be right back after these messages.
Wake Up with Bill Finch is live on WICC 600 and 95.9, the voice of Connecticut. Speak your mind. 203-333-9422.
Listen, we've got about 10 minutes left to solve the problems of a failing democracy. I noticed that I'm trying to remember what national think tank ranks democracies. Miles, you'll probably remember this, but they rank Uruguay, Australia, Ireland, New Zealand as strong democracies, along with many others, and they rank the United States as a weak democracy. Kind of sad to see, as we fly our flag proudly, that we are looked on internationally as a weak democracy. Brett Brosder, you have run many campaigns. You have messaged many things for politicians. Tell me what you think about universal voting in terms of getting the public behind this, what kind of positive messages we might be able to use, and what you see as its effect on campaigning.
Look, I think anything that's going, I mean, from both a staffer side and from a candidate side, seeing this, and anything that increases participation within the rule of the law sounds fantastic and strengthens our democracy. I think to Miles's earlier point about money in politics, I think that's a whole other set of problems that we need to address. But in terms of participation, yeah, to your point, universal participation for voters would be fantastic. That being said, we need to obviously keep fairness within the scope. And Mayor, I know you experienced this firsthand, and especially in distressed municipalities in off-year elections, they can just be fraught with fraud. So I think making sure we keep those pieces in check is critical. But Miles, I would love, I mean, you're such a wealth of knowledge and information on this and have seen it from the national scope and in your role as Secretary of State. I would love to hear what you've seen work on that front.
Right. No. I would love to. I'll try to be quick because I know we're running out of time. So a couple of quick things, which is one, it is no question about it. When you first say to somebody, we're going to make voting a required civic duty, you sometimes get a reaction of, oh, my God, we don't do that in the United States. You know, we're kind of a libertarian country. But what I find is that if you can get over that very initial reaction, and one of the things I like to use is the analogy with jury duty, which I think is very strong. In America, for the last 100 years, you are required to serve on a jury if you are called. And in Connecticut, I know this, if you get a jury summons and you don't respond, it's a $100 fine. So it's a big deal. And the reason we do that with jury service is because we want the jury pool writ large to be fully reflective of the population as a whole. Okay. In other words, to have a jury of your peers and all of your peers. And I think the same thing applies to voting, which is we should want the decisions that are made about who's going to govern us and what laws are we going to live under to be made by a fully reflective and fully inclusive electorate. So that's number one. Number two is another argument to make is that the lower propensity voters, they're called. I don't like that term, but people who vote at lesser amounts have much less power, get much less responsiveness from government. Okay. And the people who vote at very high numbers are older, whiter, richer, and more educated Americans. That's my age group, my education group, et cetera. We vote at like 75-80%. Okay. But if you go down to young people from 18 to 29, you're talking about people voting at 30-40%. Okay. And so it's half of what the older people get. And so the older people get much more attention and much more responsiveness. So if we had a situation in which everybody was going to vote, I think younger people would get more service. Communities of color would get more responsiveness. People with lower incomes who need more help from government could get more responsiveness. I think you'd see a very, very different kind of government. And the last thing I'll say is that it changes, Brett, you'll be interested in this. It changes, if you think about it, completely changes the way campaigns are going to be run. Right now, the way campaigns are run is you do everything possible to get out your base, your vote. I sometimes call it enrage to engage. and then you try to suppress the vote of the other people. And sometimes you do that legally. Sometimes you do it with election shenanigans. And sometimes you just do it with negative commercials, which are not designed to persuade anybody. They're just designed to get you to stay home because the candidate you thought you liked is actually a serial killer. So anyway, but if everybody's going to vote, then everybody is listening. And you have to craft a message that will appeal to everyone. Okay, you can't win just by getting your diehards out. So I think this will make campaigns much more about education and persuasion and much less about spending millions, and in the case of the national elections, billions of dollars on get-out-the-vote work. So I think it would be much healthier. I think Connecticut has a chance to really lead if we can create this task force and really make it work in a creative way. I think all of a sudden it takes Connecticut from the middle of the pack to the front of the pack, and I think that would be great.
It reminds me,
Miles, in line with that, how do you incentivize employers to let employees take the time off to go vote? I think that's been a major issue for folks of the lower middle class in America, being able to get out and show up at the polls on election days.
You know, look, if an employer is bound and determined to be, you know, kind of a jerk about it, I suppose they could be. Although, again, with early voting and with more mail-in voting, you have much wider options, even if your election day is busy. But I think overall, if I were an employer and I knew that everyone, all the people who worked at the firm were required by law to vote, my guess is that would actually incentivize employers to let them have the time to do that.
It seems to me that we've got to make a cultural shift, Miles. We have to take jury duty. It's duty. I understand duty, but electing people, it's a fun process. I mean, Brett's made a living off of it. You know, we've got to celebrate our elections. Why are we hiding it on a Tuesday? Why do we have primaries on August 13th when there's nobody home? It seems to me that the powers that be don't want to have a good turnout. They want to be able to manipulate a smaller number of votes or by the margin of election, either legally or illegally. When we vote just seems to be the common sense first place to start. You should have a weekend for voting. It should be your pizza weekend, your sausage weekend. Everybody get excited. You're going to go elect somebody. And, you know, we used to always get behind the winner, and we didn't try to overturn elections by trashing our Capitol and killing police officers. Unfortunately, we've done that recently. And we hope we never do that again.
Yeah.
But how do we get the date changed so it's easy?
You know, it's interesting. I could imagine the task force really looking at that. The United States has more different elections than anyone else. So consolidating dates, I mean, you could imagine having municipal elections in the even number year, the same year as the state elections, with a higher turnout. You could imagine primaries being on a uniform date and certainly not in the first 2 weeks of August. Anyway,
well,
so I think there are a lot of things that you
all
could
those
do
things we could
if
get.
The point was getting to 100% participation.
We could get this task force through if everybody calls their legislators and asks them to vote for House Bill 7242. We'll change the way Connecticut elects people. We'll elect better people, and we'll save democracy. Thanks to Connoisseur Media and our guest, Miles Rappaport, Brett Brosner, for joining us this Sunday morning. Tune in next week to another exciting episode of Wake Up Connecticut. On the Voice of Connecticut, WICC, 600 AM and 95.9 FM. Goodbye, everybody. Happy Easter. Happy Passover. We'll see you next weekend.